House SR2 Committee, call to order. And our first item on the agenda today is the introduction of committee bills. And we have, this is a work session for the purposes of the introduction of the committee bill. Would you give us a short description, please, Sandy?
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, first LC in front of us is LC 2627-1. Creates certain requirements for removal and remediation actions relating to the Willamette River and for disposal of toxic or hazardous substances on Ross or Hardback Island. Declares an emergency to be effective on passage.
Okay. Is there any discussion? Wait a minute, we need a motion.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the introduction of LC 2627-1.
Representative Leonard moves LC 2627-1 to be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion?
That'll be a separate motion. There's two different bills.
Hearing none, so ordered.
Mm-hmm.
And the second bill.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I move the introduction of LC 2627-2 as a committee bill from my good friend from Portland.
Thank you.
You need to help Portland out, right?
Representative Cruz moves LC 2627-2 as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. And the third bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the third LC is LC 3468. Specifies that native species, including species naturally spawned or naturally descended from species indigenous to Oregon.
Okay. Representative Lee.
Yes, I move LC 3468.
Representative Lee moves LC 3468 to be introduced as a committee bill. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, just maybe a potential amendment. There are some species that are native to certain parts of Oregon and not native to others that have been given that designation. For example, the Columbia whitetail, which is not indigenous to southern Oregon, but now is an endangered species in southern Oregon. So I think it would be interesting to look at possible amendments to look at regional differences also.
I think the committee would be willing to look at those amendments as we get to discussing these bills. That's a good point. Any other discussion? Okay. Any objections? Hearing none, LC 3468 is moved to forward as a committee bill. Close the work session on introduction of committee bills and open an informational meeting on the coastal landscape analysis and modeling study, otherwise referred to as CLAM. And my first question, I suppose, of the panelists is, did they bring us a supply?
I could use that in a moment.
Yeah, we have with us Norm Johnson, Tom Spies, and Gordon Reeves to make presentation.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we're honored and happy to be here. We'd like to present to you an overview of a project called CLAMS, which actually has nothing to do with clams, but it's a catchy name. And it's really an effort to look at the whole ecosystem and try to understand how many different parts, both human and ecological, fit together, using the Coast Range of Oregon as an example. And we'd like to present to you then a short presentation that describes the project. We've also got some handouts. I think that testimony that one is a brochure that describes the effort, and another is a little short testimony of some of the highlights of what we'll talk about today. My name is Tom Spies. I'm a research forester with the Pacific Northwest Research Station. not with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, as was indicated on your little handout. And other members of the team are Norm Johnson, Oregon State University, and Gordon Reeves, also from the Pacific Northwest Research Station. And so we're going to do a tag team effort here and kind of go through a little slideshow. And Norm, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Norm Johnson, College of Forestry, Oregon State. CLAMS is an interdisciplinary effort that's been going on for a number of years, between the PNW station, between the PNW station and Oregon State University. Tom Spees is the leader of it, and I'm co-leader. It involves a variety of scientists, one of whom is here today with us, Gordon Reeves, from the PNW station in Oregon State. In addition, people from the Oregon Department of Forestry are involved, and also Bill McComb, who used to be on our staff there at the college, but now is at the University of Massachusetts. And I don't know how well you can see this map of the ownership of the Coast Range, but I think that's where we need to start in the discussion, because it helps explain how we think about the Coast Range in our analysis. The state lands, of course, the Tillamook Forest up in the north are reddish maroon. Can you see the reddish maroon on there? Okay, thank you. BLM lands that are scattered throughout the Coast Range, many of the checkerboard lands down toward the southern part of it. They're light green. U.S. Forest Service is dark green, the Siuslaw National Forest. Private industrial, and in the Coast Range, there are large blocks of private industrial land. That is the bluish purple. Something we call private non-industrial land, which is really the family homes, farms, and ranches scattered throughout the Coast Range. They're very light there. On the eastern edge, that's actually mostly agricultural land, but you can see in the heart of the Coast Range kind of slender snakes of this light color, that's at the river bottoms. And non-industrial, we call them private non-industrial landowners, but it's really a variety of people. In fact, I'm one of them. I have 7 acres right out in the eastern edge. And then miscellaneous public land. It's probably the most complicated mosaic of ownership in Oregon in terms of a mixture of landowners. And that's illustrated in part by the diversity of policies for the different owners. And for this diversity, it might be easiest to talk about the Forest Service and BLM, the state, and private industrial and non-industrial. Of course, the Forest Service and BLM are under the Northwest Forest Plan. The state of Oregon is under the new forest plans that are either pending or just newly approved, especially in the Tillamook Forest. And, of course, the private industrial and non-industrial forest lands are under the Forest Practices Act. In terms of goals, the Forest Service and BLM, of course, under the Northwest Forest Plan, they've really shifted from timber production to protection of biodiversity. Late successional no-growth forests emphasize threatened endangered species and aquatic organisms. And there's some emphasis on commodities, but it's much less than in the past. The state of Oregon is, of course, focused on healthy forest indigenous species and producing abundant timber. Private non-industrial priority to growth and harvest of trees while protecting the environment and fish and wildlife. And you see the strategies. In the federal lands, it's a reserve strategy by and large, large extents of reserves with some matrix. That's land where timber production and other uses can occur in between. With what's called green tree retention at harvest and also adaptive management areas. The state of Oregon, as you may have heard, is committed to a structure-based management approach. And at least in the past has been pursuing a habitat conservation plan, private industrial and non-industrial lands. They're, as it says, their priority is to growth and harvest, but they do retain trees and clear cuts, and also we have the water protection rules. Now, at the heart of CLAMS is an attempt to project what in aggregate these strategies will add up to in terms of what we're interested in, because many of them were put in place while looking somewhat at the other ownerships, really focused on the particular ownership in mind. So are these policies that we have and strategies sufficient to sustain the values we're interested in the Coast Range? That's really at the heart of the CLAMS effort. And just one idea about how complicated the ownership mosaic is. This is the potential influence of one owner on another. As an example, the private industry, how much of BLM land is within 1,000 meters or about 3,000 feet of the forest industry land to really show how these owners are sitting next to each other. And by our estimate, 89% of the BLM land in the Coast Range is within 3,000 feet or 1,000 meters of forest industry land. In terms of non-industrial private lands, ...66% is within 3,000 feet, 1,000 meters of the industry. 47% of the Forest Service is within 3,000 feet or 1,000 meters of non-industrial private. 36% of the industry is within 1,000 meters of the BLM. And finally, only 7% of the industry is close to the Forest Service. So you see the difference there, where almost all of the BLM land is intermixed with the forest industry at the top, but little of the industry land is close to the Forest Service. And the purpose of this chart, I know it's a bunch of numbers, is to illustrate how the ownerships are very close to each other in many parts of the Coast Range.
What I'd like to do now is kind of go through the project and show some examples of how we're trying to project this landscape forward in time and understand what some of the consequences might be to different measures of biodiversity, including aquatic systems as well as the terrestrial or the wildlife on the land. So the major objectives of the project are essentially, first of all, to get a handle on what the current and historical conditions are in this area. It's one of the biggest challenges of any effort, be they the Oregon Plan or any effort to do for the restoration and management, is to try to put together the big picture. How does this fit? How does this small action in this one place fit in terms of the bigger place? And it's getting this sense of place that we think is lacking in many efforts. A second objective is to develop some ways of measuring ecological and socioeconomic responses. Oftentimes, when we talk about some of these natural resources debates and issues, it's difficult to talk about it in measurable terms, particularly on the biological side. Third is to develop some spatial tools that policymakers, such as the State Oregon Department of Forestry, can use to evaluate alternative policies. Fourth is to look at the effects of current and alternative policies on these different measures. And then finally, we want to look at some fundamentally different approaches to see, have we thought of all the possibilities for ways of mixing all of these different management objectives together on the landscape? So we're putting together a systems model, as we call it, and in the end, we really want to come up with a synthesis of the effects of alternative approaches. That's where we'd like to get to. Now, to get to that point, we really have to bring a lot of information together in a research environment. And this involves pulling together data on things like habitat for focal species, successional stages, recreation, aquatic habitat, watershed condition, landslides and debris flows, timber volume and value. All of that information has to be brought to bear if we can pull together a credible scientific analysis of this problem. And, of course, that involves developing models of various sorts, and we won't go into details of that today. We'll just show you some of the results. But to build those models, we also need to know something about the current existing stand structures in the Coast Range. We need to know something about how the different landowners intend to manage their lands. And we do that by asking them or surveying them. We need to know something about stream layers and where the watersheds are. Things that, when we began this project, we thought, we'll just go ahead and get a stream layer or get a watershed layer, meaning a map. And, of course, we realized that there's no consistent map that covers all lands. So we had to build our own, essentially build our own stream layer or build our own watershed layer. So one of the first things we do is try to set the context for the Coast Range where we are today. And one of the ways you can do that is to look at the amount of old forest, which is one of the dimensions of some of the debate. And if we look at the amount of old forest from what we estimate from historical work in the past, we estimate that probably ranged between 20 and 80% of the Coast Range was covered in old forest over 200 years old, following this distribution, with an average of about 50% of the Coast Range at any one time in the past being in old forest. Today, we estimate that about 5% of the Coast Range is in old forest, that is forest over 200 years old. So from that perspective, we think that we're essentially outside the range of what you might have expected would have occurred in the past for any watershed or any area that you might think about. Now, another way to think about this is to look at it more dynamically. That's one of the big debates, of course, in forest management today and watershed management is how do we deal with the dynamics, the fact that natural systems were never static, they're always changing and moving around. And this is just a little example of where we've put together a little simulation to show what we think the fire history of the Coast Range would have been in the past. Now, if you look at this diagram, you'll see that the light-colored blobs on here are essentially young forests that would have regenerated after fire. The dark areas at the other extreme are old-growth forests, and the other shades of green in between are intermediate-age forests. This is an estimate of how we think the forest mosaic might have looked like in the past, but we've also been able to then kind of animate this for the last 3,000 years. So what I'm going to show you is a 3,000-year simulation in 15 seconds of how this forest mosaic may have changed over time. And so what you see is that this is essentially simulating fires and regrowth over the last 3,000 years in the Coast Range. A couple things you see is, first of all, there's always some old growth in the landscape. It's just that it tends to be moving around from century to century. And the second thing is you see that there's always some younger forests. So it's been a dynamic mosaic that we've operated under in the past. The question is, how does current management stack up against this? And what are the consequences of not obviously being able to reproduce the past? Because we know, of course, that we can't go back to the way things worked in the past under a wild landscape. But some of those behaviors of those wild landscapes are important to maintaining the diversity of species and watershed processes. So the other thing we have to do is figure out where we are today. This is an estimate of different species. This is a mapping of where Sitka spruce and white oak and hemlock are that we need to be able to pull together for analysis. This is a map essentially of our estimate of where the big trees are in the Coast Range. That is, trees that are essentially over a yard or so in diameter at breast height, about this big. As you can see, most of those big trees in the dark colored areas are down on the BLM lands in areas in the southern part of the Coast Range. Because of the fire history and logging history, there are relatively few big trees in the northern half of the Coast Range. Land use change is a critical part of what we're dealing with here because we'd like to project 100 years into the future to see what are some of the implications of some of the current approaches to management. And so we're actually looking at ways of developing an estimate of how land use changes. And we're particularly interested in how we get changes that are coming from the forest land use into urban and also from agriculture into urban. So what this map shows is an estimate of today's land use. So the green is forest, the yellow is agriculture, which is in the valley, and a little bit in some of the coastal margin areas. The red is where we see a recent change from forest to urban land use. The blue at the top is where we expect to see agriculture to urban changes. Now, what we're going to do is go through a 100-year projection of how we expect to see this land use change in this area. And so by essentially in 20-year increments, you can see that the red areas are increasing around Portland as areas of forest are converted to urban land. There's also some areas around in the immediate coastal area where there's some small valleys where development can occur. But essentially, by 100 years from now or so, we're expecting to see a fair amount of increase in change from forest to urban and agricultural to urban, particularly around the northern part of the valley where the large population centers occur. The other thing we'd like to do then is to say, well, what about within the forest management area, where the people are managing for timber and other uses? And here we have to talk to forest industry, and we assume that they're going to be using clear cutting and thinning prescriptions of various sorts. We talk to the non-industrial private owners who tend to use clear cutting but often use more partial cutting as part of their management practices. State forests, of course, are using thinning and some new techniques based on partial cutting. And the federal lands, for the most part, in the Coast Range anyway, are using a reserve-based strategy, but they use thinning in some of the areas, and there's some cutting in the matrix. So putting together all of these particular behaviors, what might we expect the forests, how might they change into the future? And so this is a current estimate of the forest conditions in the Coast Range with a little blow-up there for one area so you can kind of see in a little bit more detail. What you see here is a whole array of colors. Just ignore the top part for the moment. The non-forest areas are in gray, but the bright color yellow and red are regeneration that's recently cut. Broadleaf is in red, that's deciduous vegetation. And then you get a series of greens and a series of blues. The greens are where we have conifers and hardwoods mixed together. The blues are where we have primarily conifer forest. And then the darker that is, the larger the diameter. So, for example, the blue series of the conifers goes from small conifers that are about 10 inches in diameter up to conifers that are 30 inches in diameter. And that's what that sequence. So, again, we'll kind of step through what our models are projecting as we move into the future. And as you can see, as we've gone now almost 100 years out into the future, there's an emergence of a new pattern in the Coast Range. And let me just go back to kind of show how that might have happened. So today, if you look at this map, you don't really see the ownership patterns very strongly because of the cutting history on the federal lands and disturbance history. But as we move forward in time, what you see is the darkening of the federal lands as they become more dominated by conifers and those conifers increase in size. So we're seeing the development of a whole new landscape, a high contrast landscape, where for the most part we've got the big trees and the conifers and the federal lands, and the industrial lands are essentially managing on short rotations. And so those conifers and those forests are staying relatively small. And so by 100 years out, we have an emergence of what we call kind of a divided forest, of where the old forest is on one ownership and the young forest is on the other. And the big question is, what are the implications of this to wildlife and fish? So we're looking at measuring biological diversity in clams in a number of ways. First of all, looking at a number of what we call focal species, and these can be species such as the northern spotted owl or habitat for some salmonid species, as you'll hear about in a minute. We're also looking at groups of species, community guilds as they're described, or habitat guilds. And then we're also looking at the landscape as a whole to try to develop some ways of understanding how to think about whole ecosystems in terms of either the landscape pattern and the watershed scale habitat conditions or the dynamics. And we've got some efforts looking at landslide and debris flow potential in the Coast Range to try to map where the risk is and what it might mean to fisheries habitat. And so those are the ways that we're trying to develop some measures of that we would apply to those maps that I showed you to say, well, so what? What's the implication of these map changes that occur over time? And one example here is where we've taken habitat for the northern spotted owl, and we're projecting how it changes from low, in this case in 1995 in the light color, to higher amounts in 2095 as the forest grows up and we get more multi-layered forest developing for a portion of the Coast Range. We expect to be able to do this for a number of wildlife and aquatic organisms.
we need to?
Just the trigger button.
Okay.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Gordon Reeves. I'm a research fish biologist at the Pacific Northwest Research Station in Corvallis. I'm involved with the aquatic component of CLAM, which is turning out to be a major portion of it. Our primary emphasis is to see, again, similar to what Tom was talking about, looking at the aggregate of these policies and management actions in terms of the potential impacts on fish habitat. We're not dealing with fish population per se in this effort. We're hoping to be able to bring those in down the road if we work with the National Marine Fisheries Service and some other group. But at this point, we're strictly dealing with fish habitat. We're trying to deal with the range of species found in the coast range, coho, steelhead, and chinook primarily. And what we're doing is looking at the distribution of these within a watershed and looking at different reaches in terms of where you find these different fish and what are the habitat relationships that they require. And then we're taking that up and looking at the watershed conditions that then lead to the in-channel condition. So it's moving from the fish to the habitat to watershed conditions so that we can begin to evaluate the potential impacts of the aggregate of policies on the forest plant. One of the things we're doing as an example with coho, we're looking at where we find coho population. Well, we tend to find them in these low gradient stream channels. Then we can begin to look and say, well, where do we find that on the landscape? And here's just an example from the mid-coast, which I can't remember exactly the boundaries of the mid-coast. That was from Siuslaw to Lincoln City. So this is looking at where we find these low gradient streams with regard to ownership. And you can see in this particular case, primarily these low gradient systems are in the private industrial, private, non-industrial portions of the landscape. So if you're looking at where the key coho habitats are, they're not on the federal land per se, but they're more in the lower gradient reaches on the private land. We're starting to see that for steelhead, it's the opposite. Steelhead prime habitat is in the higher gradient system, which is predominantly in those federal lands. So we're beginning to get some sense about where things might happen on the landscape with regard to these particular species. The other thing we'll be doing is being able to evaluate alternatives to timber harvest in terms of different ways that we do it. One of the things we do now is we, particularly on the federal land, we do what's called staggered setting. We try to distribute disturbances among watersheds in order to minimize the total impact. One of the things we'll be evaluating is this really a better setting than something like this, where we make concentrate activities and in a given watershed for some period of time and then move into another one. And so we'll be looking at alternative strategies for not only managing the forest, but at larger spatial scales as well.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Have we gotten far enough along in any of this type of management strategy to be able to have any sort of wild projections other than the models?
Well, the wild projections will come from the models.
Someday, if you're managing it, it'll come from physical conditioning, right?
Right. I mean, one of the things we deal with here, Mr. Chairman, is that some of these scenarios we aren't able to try simply because of legal constraints. For example, if we were to something like this. There are restraints in terms of cumulative effects of threshold concerns by NIMS and other agencies that would preclude us from really trying a lot of this stuff on the ground. And ecologically, we may be better off, you know, with some different ways of doing things than the way we're currently going.
If I could, can we hypothesize that A or B, not one is superior or potentially superior to the other as far as the environment. Could we hypothesize? I know we can hypothesize it, but is it somewhat reasonable to say that this would be a better case scenario than the previous slide that you had?
That's exactly where we're headed with this. I mean, and we should be able to do this here shortly.
And if that's the case, can we look at the the possibility of models to use as something to get by some of those legal hurdles that we have?
Well, that's exactly what we're hoping. I think that's the overall goal of CLAM, is to allow policymakers to begin to explore these types of options so that you can have a better handle on what potential ecological economic impact might be to implement those policies. So this is one thing. The other big issue is landslides and what the impact of landslide. What we're exploring is, landslide is a four-letter word with regard to fish these days, and some of our recent research is showing that's not necessarily true, that landslides can be a positive benefit to streams. And rather than, we're seeing that within the network of the intermittent streams or landslide-prone streams, there's a small subset that really affect the channel. And so we've identified those here where this map might be painted all red if you're just interested in landslide. There's a subset of these streams that really impact the channel. And we'll be able to tell you where those, probably within 2 weeks, we'll have a whole map of the coast range saying where these subset of streams are, what the potential contribution is with regard to wood and sediment to the stream, and what reaction or the response of the fish habitat might be over time to various management scenarios, depending on what you do along these types of channels.
Please.
Okay.
Could that be characterized, the light green and passive management?
Well, I would say there have to be, in many cases, we're talking about plantations that you would probably want to actively manage to increase, accelerate the development of large trees in there so that when the next set of landslides happen, they deliver not just sediment, but they deliver sediment and wood to the channels.
What you're talking about is having the overburden there and then letting nature select what goes into the stream.
Right, and what we're showing here is that you don't need to do it everywhere. That there's a subset of those with regard to the landslide that might be more, ecologically important than others. So like to say, within 2 weeks, we'll have this done for the entire Clams area. Okay, the other thing we're doing is looking at historical conditions in terms of what the parts of the coast range looked like historically. This would happen to be some work that Patricia Benner did on the lower Coquille River. If we're looking for where coho production have occurred historically, it's in these valley bottoms, these large river valley bottoms, these marshy, swampy areas. This is where coho production happened. And then we're able to show where we've had major changes. So it's not just a forestry issue. There's agricultural involvement here as well in the terms of where changes have occurred with regard to fish and fish habitat. Okay, and then one of the things we'd like to do is, right now there's no clear picture about what recovery is going to look like in terms of the distribution of habitat conditions that we want to see on the landscape. And I think there's an unarticulated expectation that we're going to do everything everywhere. We have a one-size-fits-all rules for threshold for declaring when a watershed is no longer capable of supporting fish. We've got a whole bunch of one-size-fits-all rules. What we're looking at is not is an alternative to this view of the world, and looking at saying it's more realistic to have a distribution of conditions similar to what Tom showed for forest. Should our view be more like this, where we've got a range of distribution of conditions of watersheds, and we'll be able to evaluate these types of things as we move along in clams. This I'll turn back over to Tom.
Any questions for Gordy before he sits down?
I have probably a naive question,
but
talking about the modeling,
uh-huh.
The effect of the different management practices, staggering versus the more focused large-scale disturbance to a watershed, how is the feasibility of implementing a major change in the management practices impacted by private ownership throughout the state of the forest land?
Well, it's going to be impacted, I think, in two ways. One is sort of what are they restricted in terms of what they can do under current policies, and then what are their primary objectives, in terms of in the economic cost. Are they willing to leave big trees in certain places to afford the benefits? So there's I couldn't tell you exactly what the impact would be, but we could begin to look at those, through something like this.
And the modeling then is something obviously would go to sell the idea a lot better to private.
Yeah, well, one thing we can do is better examine the impact. For example, part of what we'll do is be able to say what is the wood budget, the amount of wood that's in stream, which we know is an important component of fish habitat, under the different scenarios. We have another model that will say, over time, this is how much wood you would have on the streams if you left a buffer that was 100 feet wide versus 300 feet wide. Ones that, you know, if you buffer those intermittent streams that fail versus ones that, you know, you don't leave any buffer. So we'll be able to go through and do an assessment of the ecological impact, and concurrent with that, we'll have economic impacts as well, saying how much you might lose or gain in terms of board feet as a consequence of those of those proposed policies.
All right, thank you.
One just final component study of our effort is to really look at how the public values different measures of biodiversity. And this became very obvious to us as we got going into this effort, that it's easy to measure the cost and value of timber.
Could I ask you to reintroduce yourself?
Oh, excuse me. I'm Tom Spies. Yes, Mr. Chair, back again and committee. What we'd like to do is, one of the things that became obvious to us was that we didn't have a good way of valuing the biodiversity part, in particular in some of our economic models. It's easy to, relatively easy to measure the value of timber production. But what is the value of wild salmon or old growth forests or endangered species? And so a professor and a graduate student at Oregon State University essentially conducted a survey of 4,000 Oregonians and asked them how they value different components of biodiversity. And I'll just give you a couple of, the study's not completed yet, but I'll just give you a couple of ideas of how that was put together. Basically, what they asked to Oregonians to look at four different kinds of biodiversity plans. One, the top, based on salmon habitat. The second one, the row down, based on endangered species, as the focus of how to protect biodiversity. Third one is forest age management, you know, what kind of age distribution in the landscape. And finally, biodiversity reserve, some reserve-based strategy. And what they did is they asked the Oregonians what they'd be willing to pay for different levels of these different conservation strategies. And they're still working out some of the numbers, but we have some preliminary results on how the different parts of the state value relatively different ways of thinking about biodiversity. So, for example, they sent out a survey to three portions of the state, the Coast Range, the Willamette Valley, and the Eastern Oregon. And, of course, you can see from the bottom table that the characteristics of the people that live in those places is quite different. For example, the Willamette Valley has got the youngest population and, not surprisingly, the highest median household income. And the largest number of people with four-year degrees. In contrast, Eastern Oregon, the Coast Range, are lower in those particular measures. And, of course, the percent of people involved in the forest products industry is much less in the Willamette Valley than it is in the Coast Range or in Eastern Oregon. And so what I'll present next is just one ranking of these different populations as to what they thought about different conservation programs relative to other public programs. Now, let's know this may be a little difficult to read. But basically, at the top, what you're seeing across the bottom scale is a ranking from whether they value them as not important to extremely important on the right side, and then the different programs. So at the top, whether you're from Eastern Oregon, Willamette Valley, or the Coast Range, which are the different colors, improving education came out as top compared to all of these other programs. And the programs were reducing crime, improving health care, protecting rural communities from job losses, improving public roads, reducing unemployment, and then these four different biodiversity strategies came in at the bottom, salmon, forest ages, reserves, and endangered species. And so what you see here, the first thing to see here is that the public valued education and crime, reducing crime and health care higher than they did these environmental programs. But the interesting thing is the variability between region. Of course, the Willamette Valley had a different take on these than, as you might expect, than the Coast Range in Eastern Oregon did. So the Willamette Valley is in the maroon bars. And if you look at the maroon bars, actually the Willamette Valley valued salmon and forest age classes equal or greater than to what it did for reducing unemployment, improving public roads, and protecting rural communities from job losses. So depending on where you are in the state, of course, your perception of the relative importance of environmental protection and biodiversity varies. And so the story here is that we can use information like this coupled with information on what people will be willing to pay to kind of assign a potential economic value to protection of salmon or protection of old forests. In conclusion, we think that our research program has a number of contributions that could be made to something like the Oregon Plan. First of all, we can provide spatial databases. We've developed the first stream layer that goes across all ownerships. We've developed a consistent watershed layer. These can be used by watershed councils and other groups seeking to analyze particular localities. We can provide a framework for prioritizing watershed restoration and conservation. Right now, when I look at the Oregon Plan or some of the other restoration efforts on the federal lands, they tend to be project specific. One bit of activity here, another bit of activity there. It's hard to get the whole picture. It's hard to get the context for any one of those activities. We think an effort like this can provide the context so that you can say, well, here's a high priority area where if you did restoration, you could really make some improvements to habitat. Here's another area where a lot of effort might not really pay off as much as in another area. We can look at this whole question of land use and how it affects different ecological conditions and potentially population status of salmonids in different watersheds. And we can compare alternative ways. As Gordy Reeves mentioned, it's difficult, if not impossible, to do experiments in these landscapes to compare alternative ways of doing forest management. It takes a lot of work just to get one experiment put in for one small stand area. So by modeling, we think we can actually present some, look at some alternatives in ways that couldn't be looked at before. So we think this effort really has an opportunity to really, in a sense, provide some joint learning. The data and information will be made in spatially visible form so people can understand and visualize how some of these different landscape policies and management actions might affect different measures of aquatic habitat or terrestrial habitat. We'd be happy to answer any other questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. It was a fascinating presentation. I wish that I'd had a copy of your slides to go along.
We can arrange that.
That would be terrific. I'm especially interested in the values graph, I think the second to the last slide. Thank you.
Okay.
A couple things. I noticed way back early when you showed spotted owls, you're still considering spotted owls to be an old growth species?
No.
Okay.
Old growth
because the slide did. So.
Yeah, what we developed is a model of owl habitat that is based on forest structure. Whether that's old growth or not is another question, but it's based on the sizes of trees, the landscape pattern, and it's not tied to owls will do fine in forests that they don't require forests over 200 years old.
Right.
They can get by, and as long as there's some multi-structure, they don't need all of the parts that are typically associated with an old-growth forest.
Mm-hmm. And the other question would be to the slide Representative Tomei referred to. I guess at some point in time, if we're going to do public opinions and we get to true costs of recovery activities, and for example, I think it would be interesting to find out what people thought as to, for example, what part of their power bill was actually going to salmon recovery and different things like that. I mean, are you looking at factoring those things in?
At this point, we haven't, but I think we've essentially just scratched the surface of, I think, some very fascinating research in terms of public perceptions of environment and what they're actually getting out of different services from the environment. And we don't currently have some plans to do that, but that's something that certainly could be done.
One more follow-up, Mr. Chair. I guess, especially when you look at the difference in the Willamette Valley folks who, I think they view forest issues, salmon issues, and stuff like that. I mean, that's changing somewhat, but they view it as somebody else's problem, and they think they ought to fix it without any direct impact on them. And so.
Yeah.
So I think if we can show to these folks that they are, in fact, contributing some of their own dollars to it, it would be interesting to see how that opinion would change.
Right. And what we hope to do with integrated research like this is really try to make some of those linkages between human decisions and the environment and have it go both ways. And again, this is a project that we've been going on for a few years. It's a big complex undertaking. There's certainly a lot more that could be done, though.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative King.
Thank you. That was a one of the strongest, you know, forest presentations I think I've ever seen. And I think I saw a presentation a couple of years ago that was some of the research you were doing that, you know, has, you know, moved on here.
Yes.
And that one of the things that we didn't see much in this, because you covered so much area, was the profile of ownership, you know, right down in the riparian areas. And I was real struck, I think, when I saw it before, how many, you know, small private landowners there are, you know, versus, you know, the big acreage, you know, institutional holdings. And I think there's a lot of policy implication for us in terms of that count. So I think it would be helpful for us to, you know, get some information on that, whether you characterize something now or get something to us later. That probably be helpful.
We certainly can do that. And I think, as Gordon Reeves mentioned earlier, there's quite a different pattern of ownership in the riparian zones, particularly for the large low-gradient streams where a lot of the best salmon habitat is. It's not controlled by forest industry. It's not controlled by the Forest Service. It's controlled by the small non-industrial owners to a large degree.
And how many of those are there, roughly?
A large number. I don't know. Norm, do you?
Is it tens of thousands?
Yes. Yeah.
And then another question, a little bit of a follow-up on the owls. And I'm glad to see that the insight's, you know, progressing along, just as I think we, you know, would ask it to be. But in the owls, in the mixed structure, are you referring to breeding pairs, or are we, you know, saying that these are, you know, including adolescent floaters, and we still don't know about breeding pairs?
What the map that we showed was essentially a map of nest potential, and then also the landscape that might support a foraging pair of owls. This is an index. It's there's a whole other effort going on to try to link the behavior of the owl populations to landscape features. We're following their effort. Our effort is essentially simplifying some of that information into some indices that we can use in this modeling effort. But
I can follow in. I believe you just said then that you believe these are areas where, you know, that are nestable and where breeding pairs, you know, can habitate, but it's not verified that, you know, this is just nesting pairs.
What we've done is we have the data to verify the model. In fact, we've got all, for one large part of the coast range, we have all the nesting pair locations identified in a GIS, and we can verify how well this model works for those.
And so you haven't integrated the pairs with the model?
No.
No,
that's correct. That's correct.
Yes, it's true that you have not done it. Okay.
Yes.
Right. That'd be interesting. Thank you.
Yeah. Other questions?
It was a very fascinating presentation, and we thank you for it. I guess I have some questions, too. I get a little bit on the willingness to pay the socioeconomic, I guess, issues. You talked about the environment versus health care or whatever the others, you know, might have been, and that the environmental issues tended not to rank as highly as the top three or four. I'm curious. It seems to me very difficult variables to get a hold of with this, because things like health care or things like my children's education are items that, you know, the biggest portion of the people have real personal contact with, as contrasted to the environmental question, is probably in most cases an abstraction to people responding to questionnaires. And I would hypothesize that people would respond less strongly to abstractions than they do to things that they can relate to on a personal level. And I know as you proceed through, and I assume as you proceed through, those will be some kind of variables or things you would be concerned about, you know, with that. I mean, it's easy to say, of course, that everybody's in favor of saving trees or salmon or spotted owl or whatever it is until we get down to a point that we don't have jobs or we don't have power or we don't have, you know, some of the other things with it. But one of the other things that, and this isn't so much a question as it is just kind of an observation, and I applaud what you're doing. I think it's very good. But it strikes me that this is management, you know, of a physical environment that you're talking about. You're putting together the tools to manage a physical environment. Is that correct?
Yes. To look at the consequences of management or of various sorts. Yes.
And so I'm curious at how some of the you know, the environmental some of the folks who like this purist back to nature sort of thing are going to respond to this artificial management of this physical environment.
Well, I should say that we are building a model that could look at any ways that humans use this, and it could include no management at all. In fact, one of our options is essentially let the forest grow and don't cut any trees. So we have the capability to look at the sort of the reserve or the wilderness perspective insofar as we understand how those wilderness areas or reserve areas will change over time under a natural no management kind of scenario. So even though we sort of talk about it in terms of policy alternatives or management alternatives, one of those can be a totally passive approach. So we're not precluded to looking just at active management.
I'm not sure that's exactly what
okay. I'm not. Maybe I misunderstood the question.
Where I was going, what I was looking at, and of course I do appreciate the distinction between active and passive management. That if in fact we let everything grow, fundamentally is a form of management too. I mean, we have made a decision to proceed in some particular line. But I'd be very, very anxious to follow the work you're doing, the research you're doing on this. I do find it very fascinating, and I think that the material you have will be of great value to other people in this body in future sessions as they start or continue to deal with some of the problems that we had to deal with. So I personally really appreciate it, and it was an excellent presentation, and thank you for it. Thank you for taking the time to come and bring it to us.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee. We enjoyed the opportunity to share our research. We don't often get to get out of the lab and tell people what we're up to, so we enjoyed the opportunity.
Well, when you get that last 2 weeks and you've got everything done, come back and see us
okay.
with some new pictures.
Okay. All right. We will. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. At this point, we have the IMST. And every time I say the IMST, you know, use the word for it, I tend to make a mistake with it. But it's the interdisciplinary, or the independent, and I did it again, multidisciplinary science team. We have with us today Dr. Norris Liketowicz. Thank you. And Dr. Percy. Is that correct? Yeah. Thank you. We appreciate your being here this afternoon. Welcome. And we've been looking forward to this presentation. We have asked all of our staff to have a copy of the report before you got here so that everybody's had some chance to look at it. though we would admit, I think, that our questions are probably going to be sophomoric, and so bear with us with that.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Logan Norris, and I serve as the chair of the independent multidisciplinary science team. And I can say that fairly smoothly, but I've had a lot of practice, I think, more so than you. So with me here today are Dr. Piercy and Mr. Likatowicz, who are both also members of the IMST, and they may have some commentary that they'd like to make that would be over and above things that might be said explicitly by the IMST. I'm sorry that we weren't able to meet your meeting schedule previously. I think you'd wanted to hear from us on the topic basically relates to hatchery and wild fish, I think is the thrust of this today.
Dr. Norris, we appreciate that that was not your fault. The person who runs this establishment, our side of this establishment, canceled our meeting for that day, and you were scheduled to be here. And unfortunately for us, you were not able to be here on our next meeting, and you came at the first available opportunity. And so we would like to have had you here then, but it certainly was not anything that you had anything to do with. We appreciate your rescheduling.
Thank you. There are a couple of comments that I want to make here. First of all, I want to refer to two documents. One is a letter to you, Representative Jensen, with copies to basically all of the committee. And the purpose of this, a very brief letter, is just to give you kind of written material that speaks explicitly from the reports that have been made by the IMST on the matter that relates to hatchery and wild fish. And as I noted in my letter here, we don't think the information that's in these few pages is really sufficient to address a number of issues that I think are being presented to the legislature now, or things about which you might have some real interest. And so as a result of that, we're planning to conduct a scientific workshop to produce, I hope, a lot more light on what I think is a very difficult and controversial topic. And actually, my colleagues are here today not only to speak on matters that relate to specific things that have been done by the team, but I think that because of their technical and scientific expertise, they may have some other comments that they'd like to make that I think may be helpful to you, even though they may not be direct reflections of things that the team has decided. So let me refer to the second piece of paper, basically the enclosure to the letter, and let me explain to you what it is that these pages are. These are copies of some explicit pages from two different reports that have been issued by the IMST, and both of them have commentary that relate to this issue of hatchery and wild fish. So the first one that I want to refer to is page 44. From the report that we have of a scientific workshop dealing with conservation hatcheries and supplementation strategies for the recovery of wild stocks of salmonids. And in the scientific workshop, we asked the active participants in this workshop to deal with two questions that basically are listed here. So the first question was, are hatchery and wild salmonids different in ways that are important? And the answer that they provided to us, and this is a summation of what their answer was, the answer is that yes, there are differences. Yes, there are similarities that also remain. Then the hard part of the question really was, well, kind of what difference does it make? And the answer from this group of scientists that met with us were that the implications of those differences to the design of, in this case, they were talking about supplementation projects, but I don't think you have to confine that to quite so narrowly, that the implications of those differences really depend a lot on a number of individual combinations of circumstances. So then we asked the second question, what are the effects of hatchery management and hatchery fish on wild fish? And the answer was somewhat the same. What they told us was it just kind of depends on the circumstances. So the caution is recommended when giving kind of general statements or answers to a question that's fundamentally as complex as this one is. So that's basically what came out of one report. In the second report, which was the the report we just completed and released a few weeks ago on artificial propagation, we reproduced in that report, in essence, what I just described to you. And what I described to you previously was our report of what came out of a conference. So it was meant to be an accurate representation of the conference. It was not meant to be a statement by the IMST. So in the second page that's in here, then we basically reproduce what came out of that conference. And then on the next page, at the very bottom of that page, we reach the conclusion that the reporting that was done in that conference is, in fact, accurate and scientifically sound, and therefore we have adopted as a team the same sets of conclusions that were reached by the panel of scientists that we brought together in that workshop. Well, that's almost like a bookkeeping issue, but we're trying to be clear about what it is that the IMST as a team has adopted and what it has not. So what we've done is basically agreed the conclusions reached by the panel were accurate and appropriate. So the last page is also from the artificial propagation report, and all I've reproduced here for you is a specific recommendation that we made basically to ourselves. That was that we should convene a workshop to clarify the state of knowledge on the differences between hatchery and wild fish and what the implications for that might be. So that's the we do in fact plan to do that. The team at its meeting in January agreed to hold such a workshop. And I think the key points of that workshop, I'll just summarize them here very briefly for you. The first one is it's the issue that relates to timing. Our goal, I'm not sure we can accomplish this, but the goal that we've got is to have that workshop by the end of March and then to be able to provide a report of the type that we've done previously on workshops, so we'd be able to provide that report by the middle of April.
You're talking about the end of this March?
Yes, sir, I am.
2001.
Yes, I am.
Is that scheduled to be or planned to be a 1 or 2 day or how long?
It would be a 1 day workshop to really attempt to focus very tightly. I'll tell you what the key questions are here in a moment.
The reason, sir, I'm asking, at the first opportunity you have to finalize that schedule, I'd like to request you get a hold of our administrator because I'd like to make, if possible, special provisions for the committee to go to that work.
Okay. We'll let you know just as quickly as we get this nailed down.
Yes.
We do, you'll be glad to know our goal is to hold the workshop here in Salem to make it as easy as possible for you and others. If it's possible to find it
for some place like Hood River, that's fine.
The issue with Salem may be if we can find a meeting room.
Thank you.
We
got one.
The goal would be to have this very tightly focused, and I'm suggesting to the team, now they haven't adopted this yet, so this is my proposal to the team, that we would really focus on three very tightly focused questions. First question would be, in what ways do hatchery and wild fish differ, and in what ways are they the same? So I would hope by managing that conference well to get a fairly clear articulation of what those differences and similarities are, and what is the evidence that would lead us to believe that those are true statements? The second question would be, what are the short-term consequences of differences on the recovery of wild fish if hatchery and wild fish were to interact? And so as you begin to think about some of the pending legislation before this legislative session, that's the kind of question that could be quite important. The third question, I think fundamentally maybe the most important in the long run, would be to what degree do differences become entrained in the wild fish gene pool, and what are likely consequences if wild fish and interbreed with hatchery fish, which I think is very fundamental to some of the questions that I think that you're asking. So a couple of other points here about this workshop that we're planning. One is that we would invite active participants to this conference, so we will explicitly invite people to be active participants based on what their scientific credentials are and their accomplishments in this particular area. We would do this consistent with the public meeting laws of the state. so that it's a meeting that can be, it's not a, not a public meeting, it's a meeting that can be viewed by the public if they should wish to do so. And as part of that meeting, we would provide opportunities for public comment for those that would like to have something to say over and above what might be being said by kind of members of the technical panel. So, Mr. Chair, that's basically the key points that I wanted to make here, and I guess I'd like to turn to my colleagues here and ask if they have anything additional that that they'd like to add.
Excuse me,
last question. I guess what I would consider to be an interesting question to ask would be to kind of turn this thing around and say, what sorts of hatchery conditions would be necessary to get to a place where there is no difference? And we heard testimony a couple weeks ago from the tribes and their hatchery programs and the results they're having there, and obviously we're getting awfully close, and I guess it would be interesting to get to a point where we say, if this is the type of hatchery we have, these are the ways that it's run, then the difference has disappeared. And it would be interesting to see if we could ever get to an answer to that sort of question.
That's a great question. I'm going to refer to my two colleagues here, who are both fish guys, and I'm a forester, so I don't think you really want me to answer that question. Is it gross? Gentlemen?
In fact, yesterday I was at a workshop on this very subject, hatchery wild, what to do with hatchery surpluses, and we generally got around to that.
For the record.
Oh, my name is Jim Likatowicz. Mr. Chairman and committee, I think my interpretation of what was said at the workshop was that we don't understand that well enough yet to be able to pin it down definitively. What specifically, what kind of hatchery practices are going to guarantee that the hatchery and wild fish are exactly the same? They live in totally different environments for part of their life, and some, depending on the species, could be as much as a year, a little bit longer. And the only similarity between those two environments is the fact that they have water in both of them. But they're totally different, the stream environment versus the hatchery environment. And how you eliminate those environments, how you eliminate the effect of those environments on the fish, causing them to be different, is a question that we just haven't resolved yet.
Yes, sir. And I know there's some things we can't do, and I'm not suggesting that we create landslides in hatcheries and things like that, like we'll get in the natural environment or introduce disease occasionally just to make that happen. But certainly, if we don't have the answers, that means maybe we haven't asked the question enough.
Well, in fact, that was one of the points that I wanted to make in my comments. And if it's okay, I'll just go ahead and... this question of difference between hatchery and wild, and not only difference between hatchery and wild, but between populations from different tributaries, has been around, and the consequences of those differences have been around for quite a while, at least 20 years that I'm aware of. And in the 20 years that I worked on salmon for 30 years, but the last 20 years that this question has been around, I've probably attended a couple dozen workshops and conferences and meetings of scientists that were wrestling with this question. And the one common factor in all of those workshops, the one conclusion that comes out of all of those workshops is that we do not have enough information to get agreement on what the consequences are as a result of the differences between hatchery and wild fish. I mean, we get the same result. The answer to the questions that we got in our workshop this last year, the same answers to the questions that I heard at workshops that I went to 20 years ago. And I think it's a shame that there's been a bureaucratic inertia to just bite the bullet and do the studies that would allow us to have a better understanding of what the consequences of mixing these animals are. And there have been a few studies that have been done. As a general rule, all of the studies that have been done that looked at this question have shown that those consequences can result in reduced production of the wild fish, wild population, when you mix the two. However, in each one of those cases, there's been some criticism or some question that the experiment really didn't address all of the ins and outs of the question, so that there's still some debate. I think one of the things that the legislature could do in a very positive step in this direction would be to break that inertia and mandate that these studies be done. I mean, it's a shame that we've been talking about this for 20 years and we're no closer to an answer than we are today.
One more follow-up, Mr. Chair. I guess my sense, and all the time I've been in this discussion, is that it's been... what has been done has been kind of attempting to prove the assumption that there's a difference and that hatchery fish are inferior, and it's never been focused on trying to on the other side. I mean, they're turning this thing around and looking at it from the other way and what the outcome needs to be, and if indeed we are going to use science as an enhancement tool, how we get there. And I guess that's been my frustration, which is why I brought the question that maybe we need to turn this around and look at what we want at the end and design back towards that. So
that was sort of the consequence of the nature of the debate when this question first arose. There were some folks who said, hey, these animals are different. We think they're different. We can hypothesize that they're different from theory, from genetic theory, and we ought to be more careful. And on the other hand, there were arguments that no, they're not different. Salmon is a salmon. It doesn't matter whether it comes from Alaska or California. So the first studies, you're right. I think probably were designed to say, okay, we're going to show you that there is a problem, that there's something here worth looking into because we're identifying a problem, and that's been done. I think studies have been conducted, have shown that under conditions of those studies, you can get you can generate problems by mixing hatchery and wild fish. Mm-hmm. Now you're right. The experiments that need to go on is how do we use this tool now? How do we use hatcheries in a way that fully integrates the natural and artificial production in the way that we're adding to natural production and not replacing it or causing it to be undermined in some way? And I think we have identified the problem well enough so that it's there. Now the question is how do you go about figuring out the solution, and that's what just those kind of studies just haven't been done, and even getting the few studies that have identified the problem were difficult to do. As I said, I think a positive contribution would be to kind of break this bureaucratic inertia and mandate that they be done. I think it would be extremely sad if 20 years from now, people sitting in these same positions would still be saying, oh, you know, what is the differences and what are the consequences? And I think that is likely to happen if something doesn't take place. The other point I just wanted to make real briefly was I wrote a history book on the salmon problem, and so I want to talk a little bit about history.
Mr. Chair, one question before he moves on.
Okay.
Thank you.
We've got a couple in the queue ahead of you.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, it's good.
Okay.
I yield.
She, Representative Cruz yields here.
Thank you.
I just crossed Cruz.
Mr. Lukatowicz, I'm interested, how would such a study be done, the one that you've referred to?
Well, the first step would be to follow one of the, I'm not going to say the name, I'll just say IMST's recommendation. And that is to set up some of our hatcheries as research facilities in the short term until we can, as we answer some of these questions. And I think there are enough fish geneticists and fish managers now who are interested in this question that if the incentive were there, they could get together and they could design the studies and they could actually conduct them in one or two of the hatcheries that we have in the state.
For the committee's information, I'm sorry, Rick Ingalls, the secretary, but the chair will be happy to put forth any of your priority bills to this effect as a committee bill. Okay. We've got a little time on the priority bills.
Yes. Thank you.
Okay. Representative King.
It's my understanding that Oregon hasn't yet built its first conservation hatchery. But we're looking at, at doing conservation hatcheries, and it seems like, while we take a look at studying to do them, the art's moving along. That's saying we need to hurry up and probably build more than we can afford to build in order to be addressing the questions, that you have. I keep thinking when I went up to the hatchery that's, in my district up at Oak Ridge, and here is 3 million salmon that's, basically the spring run, and they're, in a cabinet the size of, our closet over there, and that's the whole run, right in that little space there for a significant part of their life. It would sure be, I think, helpful. I don't think we can address the question until we build some real conservation hatcheries and go through a learning process and do some things right and do some things wrong and expand the capacity. I think we really need a lot of federal help in doing that, because I don't think the state of Oregon budget's got the firepower. I mean, we'd be lucky to get three, let alone one.
Well, I think Oregon has had some federal help, not on the coast or the valley, but in the eastern part of the state. The Northeast Oregon Hatchery Program is, I think, modeled after a conservation approach, and they're getting federal funding for that, and they're getting federal funding for captive brood facilities, which is a part of conservation hatcheries. But I think most of that is concentrated in the northeast part of the state, and not in the coast.
Right. Now, where I count is, and the other thing too is, I know we're trying to do it, but you kind of want to honor people that are being innovative in the hatcheries to try and do this. But to be seeing jury rigging, people putting, hanging blue tarps over, concrete tanks is doing the best you can, but it's not going anywhere near what we need to be to do the art, I think.
The last point I wanted to make was this, that there's some, that the idea that the hatchery and wild fish are the same, sometimes in groups that I talk to, the impression is clearly conveyed to me that is the new and innovative thing that people want to do, and that the norm is to treat them as separate and keep them separate and manage them that way. But from a historical perspective, it's just the opposite. I mean, we managed for the first 100 or 120 years of our managing of salmon as though there were no differences between hatchery and wild, and between, and the consequences of that management is part of, helped set up the crisis that we're in now with salmon on the endangered species list. So,
Can we
categorically say that? I mean, in light of the fact that we've got the harvest and the other conditions, and I do appreciate, you know, what you're saying.
No, actually, that's why I said it contributed.
Okay.
It wasn't the, there is no single cause for the condition that we're in, but it was a contributor to it. So I think we need to be careful about going back to the old practices, and without clearly having the information and the understanding of how hatcheries could be used to ensure that if we do that, if you do treat the hatchery and wild fish as the same, that they really in fact are the same, you shouldn't assume it without that information.
Other questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair and committee members, I'd like to reiterate some of the things that Dr. Likatolich and Dr. Norris have stated. And some of this may be old hat to the committee, but I would like to read this more or less as my personal opinion as a biologist, not necessarily representing the IMST. First of all, as you've heard, there's a great deal of uncertainty in differences between wild and hatchery fish. Because of this uncertainty, I think there's a lot of risk in assuming that wild and hatchery fish are the same. And in my judgment, release of all surplus hatchery fish to spawn naturally, as proposed in Senate Bill 605, would be a serious risk to the recovery of Oregon coastal coho salmon, the OCN coho salmon, and probably other coho stocks as well. As you've heard, hatchery and wild fish are not the same. Hatchery fish have been selected by humans for hatchery production, often over many generations, which has led to domestication and reduced fitness for spawning, certainly, and rearing in the wild. This is not to say that hatchery fish are not good. Hatchery fish have certainly provided great social and economic benefits. They've also been selected to survive after release from hatcheries. If they hadn't been, they wouldn't come back to hatcheries. So they have survival rates in the ocean that are equal, in some cases, to the wild fish, usually less than half the wild fish, but sometimes they're quite equal to that. So naturally spawning wild salmonids, on the other hand, are adapted to local conditions of their specific watersheds and spawning grounds and have evolved life histories that are diverse and flexible. And these diverse life history strategies permit survival despite environmental disturbances such as the forest fires you heard about from the clam. And hence they enhance their long-term sustainability and are really the genetic stocks that we need for future hatchery stocks to improve the hatchery programs. Therefore, wild fish, not hatchery fish, have the best potential for restoring the diversity and productivity of an endemic salmon population. So I conclude, in view of the uncertainty and risk to the genetic heritage invested in the diversity of our wild salmonids, I don't think it would be prudent to release all surplus fish to spawn outside of hatcheries. This would risk the future diversity and productivity of Oregon salmonids. And this risk is especially severe, I think, in the case of OCN stocks. They have been at extremely low levels of abundance for the last four brood cycles, as you know. And the Pacific Fisheries Management Council, their OCN working group, has classified OCN cohos in a critical category of spawner abundance and certainly in great need of help in regards to recovery. So therefore, release of massive numbers of hatchery coho salmon to swamp these OCN stocks, certainly both within watersheds where they occur and possibly by strain outside of watersheds. So I realize there's a role for hatcheries and hatchery fish, and as we stated earlier, I think one of the strategies is to minimize interaction between hatchery and wild fish to protect the wild stocks, and the other one is to use hatcheries in supplementation, as we talked about before in this workshop, to sort of enhance the natural produced fish through hatcheries. And I think we need to proceed cautiously and scientifically and have carefully designed experiments, which get to some of the questions that were asked earlier. And we certainly have a lot of genetic tools now where we can do this. I want to just note in passing that one of the CHIP proposals that you're familiar with is using microsatellite DNA analysis to look at hatchery and wild differences for some coho stocks and to actually determine the fitness of those stocks with wild-wild crosses, wild-hatchery crosses, and hatchery-hatchery crosses. So I think that's the future. What we need to do is do better scientific experiments so we can learn what the differences are between these two stocks. Thank you very much.
Questions, Dr. Percy, or is that a member?
am I to imply from your testimony that maybe we can breed a super salmon here? We go across here, across there, back and forth, and come up with one that and can even avoid the former representative from Newport's nets?
That might be very difficult.
We get warehouses to grow those.
But I think that's the one point. We don't want a super salmon. We want many stocks of super salmon.
Yeah.
Because one stock is putting too many eggs in one basket.
Yeah, I think we appreciate that. Certainly in science, if we're going to follow a scientific model, and we've made some commitment, I think, on the part of this legislature to, and this state to do that, we would have to use extreme caution about how many fish we let out, where we let them out. I mean, because it would not necessarily be good science. We'd need some pretty strong evidence, I think, before we would want to carry that too far, though it may make a good discussion point for us all to build to work with. I'm surprised, colleagues. I thought you'd have a lot of questions here.
I'm thinking a lot.
Thinking of a lot of questions. I'd just like to comment and let you think some more for a minute about questions I have read through the report, the executive summary, and the full report, and I really wish to compliment you. I think it's an excellent job that you've done with this. You've asked the questions the way they should be asked, and not the way that we were talking about a minute ago, where the answer from whatever research is going to come out biased. And I really appreciate the thoughtfulness, and I realize that your reputation and questions at stake in writing on that, but I just want to express my appreciation for the work that you've done with this.
Please clarify, are you talking about the report we released here just recently on artificial propagation?
Right. I've read the other reports, too, and I have the same comments.
I might just report to you that we did brief the ODFW Commission on the 16th of February on that particular report, and I think they appeared to me, at least, to be quite receptive to what we were talking about, and in conversations with some ODFW staff after that particular briefing, Mr. Ed Bowles in particular assured me that he believed that the direction the department was intending to head was very complementary to the recommendation that had been made in that report, which reduced my tension significantly.
And would reduce mine, too. Questions? I do have, one kind of curious sort of question, and it, I think, goes to a colleague of yours at Oregon State, Dr. Lackey. He's with EPA.
Yeah.
Do I have the pronunciation correct?
That's right.
Yes. I think in one of his articles, he talked something about chasing a myth or an illusion. I like the way he writes, because he's asking a question that I've asked and nobody will listen to. That question is fundamentally, how many people can salmon afford? And he raises, I think, some serious questions about when we go for the next 100 years from, something about 17, 18 million people in the Pacific Northwest to 85 million people. The best demographic projections that we have. If I'm not putting you too much on the spot, I'd like to have you respond to that question that he's raising, or that issue.
Okay, probably perhaps each of us individually, not particularly representing the IMSB.
Right.
Actually, it was interesting. I just read the article that he has submitted basically as an editorial here just last night. And I know him quite well. I thought he was awful pessimistic. I mean, that's my short take on this. If you if you start with the premise that you, the only success, the only thing that counts as success is return to the historic numbers of, you know, pick your year, that's probably maybe reason for pessimism, because I think that's going to be pretty tough to do. On the other hand, I guess I'm an optimist enough to believe that I don't think we need to go to zero either, and so that, in fact, we can have expansion of population, maybe significant expansion of population, and still retain some of the core values that I think Oregonians hold pretty tightly to, some of which relates to populations and distributions of wild salmonids. Now, having said that, my own personal take is I don't believe that you can have the level of population expansion that you were alluding to where we continue to do everything exactly as we are doing it today or as I have done it in recent decades, because then I think Lackey's probably right. You probably can't get there, but I'm optimistic enough to believe, and I think the feelings of the people in the state are strong enough to believe that they will find a way to be able to accommodate what the changing pattern of our lives need to be in order to be able also to accommodate the needs of wild salmon.
Well, I reviewed one of Dr. Lackey's papers, I think, about 6 months or a year ago, and unfortunately, most of my comments didn't end in the final version. And I agree. I think he's totally pessimistic, and I think, for example, for three reasons. First of all, he discounts changes in ocean conditions, and we've had poor ocean conditions off Oregon since 1977, and it looks like there's good evidence it's turning around now, and I think that's going to help all the salmon stocks. Second, I think that we are making progress in regards to environmental restoration. And just the previous discussion on clam shows that we're going to have more late successional and old-growth forests probably in Oregon in the coast range in the future. And third, and probably more important, I think that the values of the populace, our social and environmental values, are increasing. People are more and more aware and concerned and value some of these things, like salmon and habitat. So I think, at least in the next 10-20 years, I think the prognosis is pretty good. Long term, I think, is more questionable because of a lot of other issues, such as global warming. But I certainly don't agree with what Dr. Lackey has concluded. Thank you.
Yeah. I guess I would just, Jim Lickertowicz, I guess I would say the same thing. I've read, and I've also reviewed his paper and read several of his papers, and I enjoy him because he does sort of cut right to the chase, but his fundamental assumption is that nothing is going to change. Everything as we're doing it now in our social and economic institutions, and even in our science, I think it's going to stay the same. And given that you make that assumption, and I think probably his conclusion is true, but. There's lots of changes that can be made, and I think the Oregonian poll last year was a major one. I think when asked why do you want to save the salmon, you know, what reasons, I would have guessed that at least half, maybe 75%, would have been for harvest, because we want to go out and catch either sport or commercial fish. But I believe the poll said something like 76% of the people wanted the salmon saved for other reasons, but only 16% for either sport or commercial harvest. And to me, that was a major shift in values. If that poll had been conducted 10 years ago, those values would have been totally different. I think it's possible to change. And, you know, whether you want to admit it or, you know, whether you want to consider it a legitimate debate or not, and I'm not going to voice my opinion one way or the other, but if you would have talked about dam removal 10 years ago, or even 5 years ago, they would have thought you were on the fringe and nobody would have listened to you. And now it's a legitimate question. Even the Corps of Engineers is talking about it and doing studies on it. And that just amazes me that kind of change could be made. I don't think the dams are going to be removed, but just to be able to talk about them, I think, is a major shift in the way we're looking at things. kinds of shifts that I think Bob's not giving any kind of credit to. So I think he's right if nothing changes. But I see signs that things are changing, and I think the jury's still out. This paper, I don't know if you followed it, if you got his paper from the OSU website. There's another one on there. It's sort of a debate, Dave Bellows' paper.
No, I got it off of his, not off of OSU's.
Oh, there's an OSU site that both of them, because one argues the pessimistic and one argues the optimistic. And Dave is a civil engineer, actually, who he says that these kinds of societal changes are perfectly feasible to make. He comes up with an optimistic balance.
Well, I realize that question was unfair, and if I hadn't recognized that you all had some familiarity with the existing university system here and the fairly strong chance that you were aware of it, I probably would have asked you before you were here, and I apologize for not doing that even. But you all make the same statement about pessimism, and it's certainly very true. He's very pessimistic. He's pessimistic about people's ability or willingness to make the changes that are necessary, and if they don't make those changes and the population continues to increase, then he's making a pretty harsh prognosis for what this is going on.
Mr. Chairman, I think he'd be most pleased to be proven wrong.
I suspect that's true. I suspect that's true. My question to you is that not a question that's worthwhile in the academic circles, in the science circles, asking, even though you may consider it to be very pessimistic?
Jim Lakatowicz, I agree. The problems we're solving are the immediate problems, mm-hmm. and we're having a very difficult time showing results and solving the salmon problem, given the conditions that we have today. And we're not taking into account fully in our recovery actions the kinds of problems and the kinds of things we're going to have to do to circumvent or to remedy those problems that are coming up in the future. And it sort of sets us on a path for a continuing series of crises, unless we try to get one step ahead. That's exactly true.
Well, thank you very much. And again, thanks from the committee for the work you're doing. We do have some legislation pertaining to MST, I think, being proposed.
Yeah, sure.
And somewhere we'd like to have your thoughts on that. I think specifically in rotation of your tenures. But that's probably another point. For
all right. I think at your convenience, we'd be glad to address that.
Representative Tomei, I think.
Yes, I. Mr. Lakatowicz, again, thank you for your optimism. That's the most encouraging thing I think I've heard since I've been on this committee. You said to get one step ahead. I'm hoping that you collectively can help us determine how to get one step ahead. I think that's what we're all interested in doing. What is it we can do to promote the state, all of us, getting one step ahead?
I think he's given us one of those things, and that's that priority bill.
Yeah.
I can introduce the case. Does work?
I might as well chime in here before you all leave. I think it's obvious that there's no lack of questions amongst everyone, but I would definitely submit that the questions suggested by the IMST for the workshop certainly need to be asked first, that what we find out, if anything, will provide the foundation upon which prompts other questions, such as Representative Cruz and I'm sure many others. So I just thank you in advance for doing that, and I look forward to attending it. Thank you.
And thank you again for the Oregon Legislature and your, on behalf of the Oregon Legislature for the work that you're doing for us. We appreciate it. Anything else for the good of the committee? Good of the order? There is no meeting on Friday. Is that for the good of the order?
That's right.
There will be a meeting the following Friday.
Cool.
That's for the good of the order. We will, for those of you who are wishing to drive across the Coast Range, look for salmon or something over there. We will try to make it a shorter meeting on March 2nd, I think it is.
Is that right? It's already March?
Yeah, that's 2 weeks from 2 weeks.
I know, thank you.
Dorchester week.
I know.
Those evil Republicans.
Yeah, that's right. Safe. Safe.